Thank you very much. And let me start by joining the other speakers and thanking the organizers for putting together a wonderful conference. I'm really, really, really happy to be in a conference where you're gonna, very good. Where we're gonna, you bring people from different approaches in quantum gravity, because the Swanplan, this thing that I'm working on, it's really about trying to find what's common in all different approaches to quantum gravity. So this talk is just gonna be a very quick review talk about the Swanplan. It's gonna be a quick hike through the Swanplan. And I'll first briefly explain what Swanplan is, and then cover some of the more interesting statements or constraints that you get from the Swanplan program. And just like in any nature hike, we'll stop by and observe the scenery. And what that means is that at some points I will be throwing questions, questions that I'd really like to discuss with some of you, throughout the conference or maybe later on in the question session, which I think are particularly appropriate for a workshop like this. Okay, so let's start with the basics, the stuff that we all here in this conference room know, which is that working in quantum gravity is tough. It is tough mostly because the scale at which quantum gravitational effects become strong, it's much bigger than what we can access today. And what that means is that it's not going to happen anytime soon that we're going to have direct experimental access to quantum gravity. There might be smart ways to go about it, maybe by looking at, deep IR or in cosmology. But in the most straightforward particle physics-like mentality, it's not going to happen anytime soon. And I would say that precisely because of this, research in quantum gravity has become essentially a theoretical field. It's completely theoretical, right? So you have different approaches. So there's a string theory, loop quantum gravity, asymptotic safety, you name it. There's many others. And each of them, they're trying to go their own way about finding what the right quantum theory of gravity is. And also, everybody is trying to connect to observations. But just from this picture, it seems very, very difficult to pinpoint any consequences, particularly universal consequences, that quantum gravity might have at low energies. And in fact, if for a moment we stop talking about quantum gravity and we focus on classical gravity, the answer is clearly you cannot say anything universal, okay? And why is that? Well, suppose that you have some effective field theory, and here I just mean the matter effective field theory, so everything else but gravity. And suppose you are given any Lagrangian, any quantum field theory you want to have as the Lorentz effective field theory, and you want to couple that to gravity. At the classical level, the only thing you do is you add the Einstein term, you change all ordinary derivatives by covariant derivatives, and then you're good to go, okay? So since you can just clearly put whatever you like here, there's no, there's no constraints on LEFT from coupling to gravity. In quantum gravity, however, if now you turn on quantum effects, things are not so clear. And the reason why they're not so clear is precisely because of the lack of decoupling in gravity, which is also known as the equivalence principle. Gravity couples to everything. It's the essential feature that we believe is true about gravity. And so what that means is that if you have a theory of gravity with matter, you cannot just ignore the matter when you're quantizing gravity. Matter is gonna feed up in your theory of gravity via loop effects, okay? So you need to talk about both at the same time, both of them together. It doesn't make sense to talk about one and not the other. If the two of them talk to each other, the logical possibility emerges there might be some effective field theories that actually cannot be coupled to quantum gravity at all, meaning there is no concrete, full quantum theory of gravity that has this or that particular effective field theory at low energies. So if for a moment we draw this blue blob and we think of it as the space of all the effective field theories, all possible effective field theory Lagrangians, again, without gravity, you could write down so that, for instance, one point in this diagram corresponds to particular values of masses, coupling, certain number of fields, or a particular effective field theory, and then some other point corresponds to a different effective field theory with different masses and couplings. Classically, any of these points can be coupled to gravity. But the core of the Swanplan program, the core of the Swanplan idea, is that there is, in fact, a growing body of evidence that not everything can be coupled to gravity. So this big abstract space of effective field theories, you might divide into regions. The ones that can arise as the low energy limit of a consistent quantum gravity, and the ones that do not. And in the field parlance, these guys we call the landscape. This is actually terminology originally coming from string theory, when the whole landscape of string compactifications was discovered. You know, the picture that people had back then, or part of the picture, was that, you know, there's such a big landscape, there's so many effective field theories that you can get from string theory, maybe you can get essentially anything that you like. And the Swampland idea refers to the complement on the landscape, that's the Swampland. These are all the effective field theories that, you know, you might have thought they can arise, they can be coupled to quantum gravity, but they actually cannot. So most of the space of effective field theories is not part of the landscape, it's part of this ugly Swampland of theories that cannot be coupled to gravity. And this identification of the landscape and the Swampland has led to this idea of the Swampland program, which is there's a bunch of us, we are just trying to identify what are the universal things, the universal constraints that you can say that a low energy effective field theory must have in order to arise as the low energy limit of a consistent quantum gravity. Okay, that's the game. How do we do this? Well, essentially, we follow a two-prong approach. On one hand, we like to have general arguments based on general principles that we think, we hope, are true in every quantum theory of gravity. For instance, that black hole evaporation is unitary, and that hopefully do not depend on the UV. Any argument you have like that is going to be very fuzzy, in a sense, because you don't really have one framework that can address all of quantum gravity at once, all of the different approaches. So this first leg is complemented by a second approach, which is once you have identified something that you maybe believe is true in effectively theories coupled to gravity, then you can check this statement against data obtained from the biggest theoretical lab that you have in quantum gravity, which is string theory. String theory may or may not be the actual theory of gravity that describes the real world, but what's for sure is that it gives you tons and tons and tons of consistent models of quantum gravity, consistent mathematical models of which are consistent quantum theories of gravity. And so if you believe you have a general argument, you can check it against string theory. And if it's true in all of those of tons and tons and tons of models, then maybe it's a real thing. So usually, you know, when I give talk, review talk about the Swampland, now I go and describe the conjectures for you, but I think that for a conference like this, it's actually a good time to ask this question, which is, you know, I've been telling you the Swampland is about trying to find universal features from quantum gravity, and then I tell you we checked it against string theory. You might ask, why string theory? Why not any of the other approaches? And the answer to that question, to me at least, is really like an operational one, okay? So as far as I know, string theory is the only framework which is sufficiently developed so as to give you quantitatively check, to give you enough data to check Swampland constraints. What do I mean? Well, remember, the whole idea of the Swampland is that you get a quantum gravity theory, produces an effective field theory at low energies, and then the Swampland is about constraining this low energy effective field theory. Swampland constraints tell you things about the masses and couplings of an effective field theory that can arise from quantum gravity. And so to check Swampland constraints in quantum gravity, I need some framework which is able to tell me, you know, this value of the mass for this particle arises in a vacuum, this one doesn't. And the only framework that I know that can do this so far is string theory. And furthermore, it gives you a big data set of vacua to check these things. Yes, this is probably a lower bound. So this is a big data set of, you know, vacua. They're not describing, none of those are describing our universe, but they are certainly consistent vacua. And so the question that I would love to discuss today or throughout the week is, can we check any of these ideas that I'm going to be telling you about in any other framework? And if so, how? Can we check, for instance, that there's no global symmetries in in other approaches. And I think there's one talk tomorrow by Astrid, and she's going to address the idea of no global symmetries in other approaches of quantum gravity. So that's a bit happening already. So before, these are all ideas that sound very good, but one question you could ask is, can you prove any of this? Can you prove any of the statements that I'm going to be telling you in the second part of the talk? And the answer is that we cannot prove them generally, but we can sometimes prove it in large context, which in any case don't cover all the examples. For instance, we can prove some Swan-Blanc constraints with holography or in perturbative string theory, but we cannot prove it in general because we don't have a framework that encompasses all of quantum gravity all at once. And that's why, out of an abundance of caution, Swan-Blanc statements are often phrased in the form of conjectures. So we have different conjectures, different statements, which have different degrees of support and validity that quantify the properties that we believe are true in any quantum gravity. There are several conjectures. In this little hike, we're going to focus on these three, the weak gravity conjecture, no global symmetries, and the distance conjecture, which are some of the best established ones, and actually some of the more powerful ones. So let's start with the first. First, an older Swan-Blanc constraint. We believe that there's no global symmetries in quantum gravity. Okay? So to understand, this is actually a super old statement. There are some statements to this effect by, certainly Banks and Dixon in the 80s, and even some phrases by Wheeler you could take to mean there's no global symmetries. And to understand what no global symmetries means, first I need to tell you what a symmetry is. Right? So by saying no global symmetries, we could think about, instead of symmetries, we could talk about charges. And a charge, it's a symmetry is a quantity which is conserved by any dynamical process. So for instance, think of beta decay. There's two conserved charges in the standard model in this process. There's electric charge, it's zero on the left, and it's zero on the right. And then there's another charge, which is also a symmety of the standard model, which is baryon number minus lepton number, which is one on the left and one on the right. Now, these two symmetries at the level of just conservation laws, they are the same. But at a fundamental level, they are very, very different. The first of them, electric charge, is a gauge charge. What that means in practice is that you can measure it from afar. If I give you a little black box and I ask you what's the electric charge inside of the black box, you don't need to open the box. You can just use Gauss's law to measure the flux at infinity, and then that gives you what the electric charge is. The other kind of symmetry, it's a global symmetry, it's a charge which cannot be measured asymptotically. If I give you a black box with a number of protons or neutrons, there's no way for you to tell me how many of each unless you open the box and count them. Okay? So both of these two things, they lead to conserved charges, but we believe, and they are both, by the way, they happen all the time in quantum field theories, but we believe only one of the two can happen in quantum gravity, and that's the gauge symmetry. We believe there's no global symmetry in quantum gravity, and now you know what the statement means. So why do we believe that there's no global symmetry in quantum gravity? Well, of course, it started with the Swan-Blanc conjecture with the most evidence, the one which is easiest to argue for. So there's many lines of evidence. So first of all, there's old arguments about how if you have a global symmetry, that's going to lead to black hole remnants, and those might, they might run in loops and ruin your effective field theory at arbitrarily low energies. You can actually prove it in perturbative string theory. The proof is in Polchinski's textbook, actually. And a variant of the same ideas upgrades to what's essentially, a proof. There's some subtleties here, but in ADCFT, and for instance for continuous symmetries, it's actually equivalent to Noether's theorem in the dual CFT. If you have that to any symmetry in the dual field theory, you have a conserved current, then that means that that symmetry is a gauge symmetry in the bulk. There's actually recent proofs using entanglement entropy and islands in flat space, and some of these papers, for instance, this one by in 2022, they actually tried to quantify how much the symmetries are broken. And finally, last piece of evidence is that this thing is always true in every string theory example, even beyond perturbative string theory. Okay, I think it's come to the point that whenever you're working on a string compactification and you find what it looks like a global symmetry, you just look for what's the brain or the instanton that's going to break that symmetry. There's just no examples of global symmetries in string compactifications. Now, this thing, you know, so that's sort of the evidence. That's why we believe it's true. As you can see, it's a mixture of general arguments and more detailed stringy arguments or arguments that are working in particular examples. And, you know, if this thing is true, if it's true that there's no global symmetry in quantum gravity, this actually has real-world consequences. Because as I said before, B minus L is a global symmetry of the standard model. So if we believe there's no global symmetry in quantum gravity, then there's just two possible fates for B minus L. One, it's either coupled to a yet unseen fifth force. So there's a fifth force which couples to B minus L. This possibility, of course, requires that the gauge coupling of this guy is extremely tiny, it's 10 to the minus 25, because otherwise we would have measured it already. Or the other possibility, which is, for instance, realized in granularified theories, is that this is not a real symmetry, it's actually broken. And, you know, you can, if this symmetry is broken, it's not a conserved charge, you can have things like proton decay or double beta decay that wouldn't happen if this thing is conserved. So, you know, it tells you something, but it doesn't tell you, by just the way I phrased it so far, it doesn't really tell you very much. Because let's say that the symmetry is broken, fine, let's say the symmetry is broken. This is not a very powerful statement unless I tell you how strongly it's broken. How often should you expect to see proton decay? Okay? If the answer is expected to see, you know, once in the observable universe, maybe it's an interesting theoretical point, but it's not very relevant. So a lot of research on no global symmetries is focused now on trying to quantify how much the breaking is, either from string theory examples or from general black hole arguments, as the paper I was mentioning before. So that's one way that people are studying this no global symmetries conjecture. And I actually wanted to tell you a bit about a different way that we have realized that this conjecture can actually become very strong, which is when you apply it to what is called generalized symmetries. A generalized symmetry, it's a symmetry in which the charged objects, rather than being, you know, like a point particle, they're extended objects like strings, brains, so on and so forth. So I'm going to tell you a concrete example of which I think illustrates the power of these ideas, but I'm going to pay a price for that, okay? To make them, as of today, the way we know how to make this no global symmetries thing really strong is by paying the price of supersymmetry, and a lot of supersymmetries. For instance, the example I'm going to discuss here is theories with minimal supersymmetry in 7, 8, and 9 dimensions, okay? Now, this is not the real world. This is not 4 dimensions, but, you know, that's the trade-off. We first study the simple example, and then we try to generalize. And this example is really simple, because these theories, they have, you know, because of the supersymmetry, the Lagrangian is fully fixed by supersymmetry, and about the one piece of data you can specify, the only thing you specify is how many vector multiplets you have. So you can have one U1 gauge field, 2, 3, 4, you pick the number, okay? So that's the only question you can ask from no global symmetries. How many vector multiplets, for these theories, you can ask how many vector multiplets are there, and what are the examples you can construct? So in 9, 8, and 7 dimensions, effective field theory reasoning essentially tells you you can have any number of vectors. These odd and even here are because of some gravitational anomalies, but it doesn't really change the whole picture. So you can, of course, effective field theory is like, well, of course, you can couple any number of vectors to gravity. I mean, it's just like EFT coupled to gravity, so what do I care? If you study generalized symmetries in this setup, you find some generalized symmetry that has to be broken. And it can only be broken because of an anomaly when the number of vectors is 1 modulo 8 in 9 dimensions or 2 modulo 8 in 8 dimensions. Okay? So that's an oddly precise number that comes from bottom-up global symmetry arguments. There's no input of string theory whatsoever. And then you can ask, fine, let's check this thing against the string theory lab. With this much SUSY, there's just like 4 string compactifications with Dittmann supersymmetry. There's just four of them. So they're easy to check. And the values of the rank that you get, they precisely match in 9 and 8 dimensions. And in 7 dimensions, there's still a mismatch. So the Swarm plan is not enough yet to pinpoint all the values you get from string theory. But it tells you there's an odd number, and indeed, all the values you get are odd numbers. So this illustrates how these ideas can be powerful. And one line of work that we're actively pursuing is trying to find examples like this in less dimensions and with less supersymmetry. Now, for the second Swarm plan conjecture I wanted to tell you about, we're going to discuss is the weak gravity conjecture. So the weak gravity conjecture is a conjecture about effective field theories where you have an electromagnetic type force, a long-range U1. And it's basically telling you that in such a theory, you cannot just have a charged state, you know, charged states with the masses and charges that you like. There has to be at least one particle whose mass is lower than its charge, okay, in Planck units. And it's called the weak gravity conjecture because this statement here is the kinematic condition that if you have two particles like this, the gravitational force is less strong than the electromagnetic force. So gravity is weak, weak gravity conjecture. Now, it's of course satisfied in the real world by electrons, so you don't learn a lot there. And the way we have a general black hole argument for weak gravity conjecture, and it's basically, it follows if we require that extreme rising numbers of black holes are able to decay by emitting charged particles via the Schwinger effect. These black holes have zero temperature, they can discharge by quantum effects, and this Schwinger effect is only turned on if you have one particle which satisfies weak gravity conjecture. It's just a kinematical constraint. So why do we believe this thing is true? Well, again, true in every string theory compactifications. You can prove it in perturbative string theory. You can argue for some version of the statement in ADCFT. And actually this one, you know, it actually touches the boundary of positivity bounds. There's been attempts to try to prove it via unitarity and positivity bounds. Although, to you know, as far as I know, this is not there's some difficulties which are related to the fact that there's a T-channel ball and gravity allows a bit more negativity than field theory. Well, the weak gravity conjecture, what is it good for? Well, as we just discussed, it doesn't really constrain the standard model very much because the electron satisfies it and that's it. But it can put constraints, for instance, in models of what is called millicharged dark matter. So one popular alternative for models of dark matter is that there's some dark sector. Dark sector has some, you know, dark photon. And then weak gravity conjecture tells you, well, if you want to have the dark photon, you must also have charged particles, and they must satisfy weak gravity conjecture. And maybe this photon mixes with our own photon. So it can be used to put constraints on models of millicharged dark matter. And there are versions of the weak gravity conjecture. Remember I was talking before about generalized symmetries? There's versions of the weak gravity conjecture for all charged objects, you know, with all, you know, it can be like part, it can be like with any dimension. And in particular, there's a version of weak gravity that applies to objects with zero space-time dimensions, to instantons. And this version of the weak gravity puts constraints on a certain kind of models of inflation, which are models of natural inflation. So for instance, it tells you that if you want to have a transplanckian field range within this class of models, it's going to be tough because the instantons are required to be gravity to generate a very strong, very steep potential. And this is actually where a lot of the interest for the weak gravity came from, originally. Now, for the last 3-4 minutes, I'm going to tell you about the last conjecture here, the distance conjecture. Distance conjecture is different from the other two. The other two I told you about, we have general black hole arguments why we believe we work in general, but the distance conjecture is a conjecture which is purely, completely extrapolated from string theory examples, okay? So this is extrapolation of the string theory evidence, and we don't have a general black hole argument for it, even though we've been searching for it for a while. So what is the distance conjecture? Of course, the upside of that is that it's the most powerful conjecture. So in string theory, we often have these massless scalar fields, which are called the moduli, and they control the couplings of the theory. And there's, you know, you can tune their vacuum expectation value, and they control whether the mass of this particle or that coupling. And so one very natural thing to do once you get this space of parameters is to crank one up as much as you can. You can crank up one of the scalars to infinity. And when you crank it up to infinity, an empirical observation in string theory is that when you do it, the scalars get a very large BEV. There's a tower of states which becomes light exponentially, and the regime of validity of the effective field theory also goes down exponentially. Okay, when I say here it breaks down, it's always good at sufficiently low energies. But at any given energy, the range of validity, you know, at any given value of the scalar field, the range is going lower and lower and lower. And the distance conjecture is just a statement that this behavior actually just happens literally in every infinite distance limit we have ever explored in string theory. Okay? That's actually, in a sense, is quite surprising. Some of the limits are very, very weird, and still it goes true. There's a connection to no global symmetries, because in every infinite distance limit, empirically also it happens that some gauge coupling goes to zero. Gauge coupling goes to zero means there's a global symmetry, and we don't like global symmetries in quantum gravity, so it makes sense that the theory breaks down there. And in all the examples that we know, this tower is either a tower of Kaluza-Klein, it's a Kaluza-Klein tower which signals decompactification, or a fundamental string becoming light. This conjecture is important for cosmology because during inflation, for instance, you want to have an inflationary field range, and it better be the case that the tower of states does not become very light during inflation. And so, for instance, we are trying to figure out this, the value of this coefficient, which controls exactly how fast this tower of states becomes light. We have, for instance, we have lower bounds for Calabi-Yau compactifications, but people are actively exploring what is the lowest value that this coefficient can achieve. And it might be relevant not just for the early universe, it might also be relevant today, because, for instance, it's actually completely compatible with experiments that there's a Kaluza-Klein tower of states of a mass of around 5 or 6 micrometers, which is maybe suggested for some strong application of Swampland principles. So I reach with this the essentially the end of the talk. I just wanted to give you a brief hike, but there's a lot more to the Swampland than I sketch here. You have, you know, you can talk about the Festina-Lente bound, dynamical coverages, and gravitational mass conjecture, species bound, non-Suzy ADSs, Euclidean wormholes, neutrino masses, the repulsive conjecture, the coverage conjecture, bubbles of nothing, convexity of the Pareto spectrum. It's a field where there's a, you know, there's a lot of activity recently. And I just want to say here, please ask about anything that caught your attention, and I really like talking, and I'm around all week. And if you're really interested, you might also consider joining our bi-weekly online seminar series. We have it on Mondays at 11 a.m. This is the website for it, so you're welcome to check it too. The take-home message is that quantum gravity imposes constraints at low energies, and that it's potentially very interesting. And it's also very fun to work on Swampland. It's very interdisciplinary. You get to do string theory, holography, a bit of quantum information, algebraic geometry, and certainly topology, particle phenomenology. And I think that this large set of things on which you work when you're in Swampland should be extended, perhaps with other approaches to quantum gravity. And this is perhaps the right venue to talk about this, which is why I'm excited about, you know, being here, maybe talking to you about it. And so with that, I really finished, and I hope you enjoyed the hike. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Yes, please.
Hi. So in the distance conjecture, is there some intrinsic understanding why the gauge couplings go to zero if you take the infinite?
Well, there's an understanding that works in many limits. I'm not sure it's fully general, which is called the emergence proposal. So I told you the distance conjecture tells you that as you go to infinite distance, there's a tower of states that become light. And empirically, it happens in many cases. There's these states are charged under, let's say, a U1 gauge field. And you know, if you have a tower of states that are charged, you need to run the gauge coupling to the deep IR, and the tower of states renormalizes the gauge coupling in such a way that the gauge coupling goes to zero.
Thanks.
Thank you. A specific question. All this is based on some associated conjectures. I'm curious about one specific one. In one, you motivated on the non-existence of black hole remnants.
Yes.
Now, I'm aware of some arguments in string theory against black hole remnants, and I'm aware of some old arguments in sort of standard quantum field theory, local quantum field
right.
theory against remnants. But I'm not aware of any more general arguments that if I If I don't believe in string theory, which I don't, and I don't believe in exact local quantum field theory at the Planck scale, I don't know any of these arguments. Do you know more?
Well, so first, even if you don't believe about string theory as the right theory of quantum gravity for our universe, it certainly gives you a lot of models which are consistent quantum theories of gravity, so they are valid to check these things. And you're asking for a general argument. There's this paper I really like by Susskind. It's called Trouble with...
Are you saying, for instance, that, I don't know, imagine loop quantum gravity is correct.
Yes.
Are you saying that within string theory there is loop quantum gravity? It's one of these models?
I'm just saying that if there's a general statement about quantum gravity, if there's really truly a universal statement in quantum gravity, should be true both in string theory and loop quantum gravity, because string theory is a mathematically consistent framework.
No, it can be one theory can be correct and one can be not correct.
I don't mean like correct about the universe, but the thing is that if we agree that a quantum theory of gravity is any consistent quantum theory that at low energies has massless spin to field, okay, then string theory is certainly an example of that. And going back to your question about the remnants, for instance, if you have infinitely many, literally infinitely many states which are degenerating mass at some finite value of the mass, then you would expect that they run in loops, couplings for the effective field theory. Now, usually very heavy states, they produce very, very small effects at low energies. But if you have infinitely many of those, they can overrun you. And a concrete example of that is, for instance, if you imagine doing the Unruh calculation for the Unruh effect.
They can, but they also cannot. I mean, there's some integral that diverges, some integral that converge.
Yeah, yeah. It's not these arguments are not proofs. This is why you check.
So I asked you if you have some...
No, if I have a general proof, I don't have a general proof.
So, again, I mean, we're trying to understand. So... many of us are a little bit skeptical about areas where conjectures are growing on conjectures are growing on conjectures, so to say. So I just want to know your insider's view of this. At what stage does one stop making these conjectures and say that, well, no, this is really too much. I mean, I should really solidify my first things completely in four dimensions without supersymmetry, and then I can build on that further.
Well, conjecture is, I think, the natural way to approach problems in any field which is very formal, doesn't have experience. So, for instance, we have conjectures in mathematics that have been going on for, hundreds of years. And a lot of this is really geared towards trying to get four-dimensional, when you try to study general properties of quantum gravity, you might explore them in a more general landscape, but at the end of the day, you want to connect to four-dimensional physics,
right?
Of course, yeah.
Right. So there's a difference between mathematics and physics, right? I
mean, the thing
in
is
mathematics,
that,
there are abstract statements that we prove. In physics, we want to say something about our real world.
I think it's about trying to say the strongest things in the most general way that you can. And phrasing them in terms of conjecture is just acknowledging that you don't have a full proof. But it's true in many, many examples of quantum gravities, in the sense massless spin to quantum systems.
Here we have a very interesting topic for discussion. Alessia, please.
Yes, so is this work? Yes, okay. So thanks for the very nice talk. I have one comment and one question. The comment is that so there has been some work in understanding some swamp land conjectures in asymptotic safety.
Okay.
And papers with also Ivano that you know. I think also the program carried out by Astrid Eichhorn, who will speak tomorrow,
yes,
in a sense it goes in this direction of finding constraints from the coupling of gravity with matter. And this is the comment. As for the question, just a brief one. So you mentioned that you have a proof for the weak gravity conjecture and no global symmetries in perturbative string theory.
Yes.
Is that valid in any space-time dimension? And is it still valid as I take the limit alpha prime that goes to zero? Because that would be the quantum field theory limit, so it would be very interesting to...
So it's a worksheet proof, so it doesn't really care about the value of the string coupling as long as it's weak enough that you can trust string perturbation theory. And yes, it works in any number of dimensions. There's a couple subtleties in three dimensions. In three space-time dimensions.
Space-time,
not space.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Okay, let us thank Miguel and move to the next talk.